Blog Talk Radio.
I'm your host, Merle Exit. Well, it's a cold day, but the sun is out here in New York City, and we're going to have a good shoe. It's all about shoe, as a matter of fact. The show is an off-Broadway show, Let's Kill Grandma This Christmas. And what we're going to discuss is what happens when shows get mixed reviews. Shows are opening, they're closing. Does it depend upon the critics? Does it depend upon the cost? What's it all about? So we're going to have on our show today the playwright, Brian Gianci, if I pronounce it correctly, the director, John DiPolito, and the producer, Robert Nicotra. It's a message from our sponsor.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
And you can get these wonderful tasting brownies at www.brownies.com. It's the holidays. It's a great gift to send somebody, because unless they're allergic to chocolate, and actually it doesn't matter, right? Because then now they have some bars that don't have chocolate in it, just in case. This is it's not something that people will say, "Ooh, I don't like it." I have a feeling they will. But, well, let's leave that alone and let's get to our guests. Now, I don't know, you're all on the air at the moment. Hello.
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 Well, how are you? John DiPolito here.
Okay, now, since I see phone numbers and I don't know who's who yet, and you don't have to tell me, I'll figure it out. All right. What I want to start with is to talk to our playwright, Brian.
Yes, how you doing, Merle? You have to
okay.
Speak. My voice is shot. I sound like Don Corleone's grandfather right now.
Really?
Actually, it's actually not as bad as it was yesterday. It's starting to come back a little bit.
Oh, but, Well, the first thing, to give a quick thing on, so in case the audience didn't listen to the last show, what the play is about.
Well, it's basically, it's a weekend getaway to Grandma Kathy's house, and the inheritance has just been announced. And basically, there's a plot to take her out for her money. And it's all done in a very hysterical kind of way with some crazy, crazy, completely dysfunctional people. That's kind of the gist of it. It's kind of set in this harsh economic climate. And kind of the question is, does Grandma still make sense financially? But so that's kind of the thing. It's a black comedy. And it kind of points out, you know, in a subtle way, kind of the absurdity of our moral values, some of our moral values.
Now, how long were you working on the script before this actually got to Off-Broadway?
Well, it's been...
At what point?
It's been about 3 years now since I started writing it. And, you know, we had this 3 years ago. It took me about 3 months to write the first version of it. And I did a workshop, a small kind of like three-day run of it. I don't know what you'd call it. But basically, we had a great response. You know, it was done in a 30-seat theater. And John helped me to direct it. And we got an awesome response from the audience. And since then, we've had, you know, John and Rob got on board to help to produce it. And since then, we've kind of been workshopping it. We had a couple readings of it. And, yeah, so I guess so it's been a three-year process to get it to where it is.
So is that a typical thing that people do? They do a workshop, like, and have, like, a small audience? Doing a play? Is that common?
I think it. Sometimes they're workshops, sometimes they just do readings. John, you might have better input on that. This is kind of my first experience with, this is my first play that's gone off Broadway.
Yeah, John,
yeah,
tell us.
It's pretty common, Merle, to take a play, especially when you're going to eventually have eyes on making it a commercial product. It's very common to give it some type of run or workshop or audience prior to going commercial with it. So, yes, it is. It's very quite common.
So is the audience consist of people that are in the business or are they people that will give you feedback or how does that work?
I think it's a combination of friends, family, professionals, strangers, people just interested in the theater. Essentially what you're trying to do is get the play up on its feet and see how it's living versus how it's reading. And it's very, very key to see something living because it's easier for the playwright and the director to discover what's working and to discover what needs work in that type of setting. So it's an excellent way to see the play in its three-dimensional living stage and make the adjustments that need to be had in order to move forward and to tighten up the play, basically, make it a better song, if you will.
And how about once the play is on, do you ever make any changes at that point?
Oh, yeah. That's where Brian comes in, and it's very important, the relationship between the director and the writer, because that communication has to be always an open line, because once the play is up and moving, there's often adjustments that have to happen in order to get it to the next level. That's a very common thing, yes.
And how about once the play is like, you've now opened, and now I've seen things of like, that, you know, does the director, like, sometimes sit in the audience and make notes? I always see people, like, making notes, and I don't think they're critics. They look like that they're making notes.
Yeah, during previews, it's really, really important to take a lot of notes as a director. And I still, when we opened, I took some notes. And actually, we're very close with this particular cast that we have, and many of them request notes from me after the show, so they know that I watch the show, so they'll come out and they'll ask me certain things about the performance, which feels more like a theater company situation for me, which I find I kind of thrive in that environment much more, a theater company mentality. So it's been great for me in that sense to have that kind of rapport with the actors who are walking up to me and asking me questions and talking to me in that manner, because I find it's just a better environment to keep the product always at a level of excellence and growing.
If, as a person watching the show, if I was there opening night, if I came back to see the show, would I notice any differences, any changes at all?
You might probably notice subtleties. Yeah, fine.
Okay,
you want to say something there?
I tried, but the voice didn't come up. Every night is a new performance. Like, you won't see anything different in terms of blocking. You won't see anything different in terms of the words that are coming out of the actor's mouths, but you might see in just the way that the audience touches the performance, because the energy of the audience makes a difference, and the energy of the actors on that specific day makes a difference. So it's every day. It's going to always be different. But it's always going to be in the general ballpark of what you saw.
Right.
I guess unless you kind of go like, if you came at the beginning of the run versus if you can't, and then came at the very end of the run, maybe it has actually evolved quite a bit.
What I notice
yeah.
more as a critic versus like if I was just, the consumer, if you want to.
It's interesting. That's a great question, Merle. I think in your case, you'd probably notice in both ways. You'd probably notice that some things have gotten much tighter. You've also probably noticed where the actors have relaxed into certain things that they feel more comfortable with as time goes on. Opening night in particular is always such a high-pressured night on the performers because it's always the most difficult audience, in the sense that most of the people who are there on opening night have either been affiliated with the project in one way or another and have read the play, seen it in a workshop, or very familiar with the material or even the actors prior to that being invited to an opening night. So it can be a very supportive audience, but equally a difficult audience to perform to because they're not experiencing the play for the first time and freshly. They're experiencing it just as they know what's coming, so to speak.
Right, yeah. Now, in terms of producing, what does the producer do, Robert?
The producer gets involved, I guess, from the very beginning. Me and John are co-producers on this, and we had to first make sure that Brian would want to work with us, and so we had to acquire the rights to produce this play. Brian as writer, and in the theater, the writer has, has all the rights and holds all the rights to the words of the play. You can't change anything. In film, you could change the words in the screenplay. In theater, you really need the writer's permission. And so we told Brian how we felt about the play and what our aspirations were, which were off-Broadway, big off-Broadway, as big as we can do it. And he was very excited. And, he gave us the rights, and we got into an agreement, and we all just started working hard on it. And then you go from developing the actual material to then planning out what type of theater you want to produce this play in, when you want to do it, what team you want to hire to help you with marketing, PR, general management. You want to do a budget. You want to be able to raise funds for that budget. You want to be able to manage that budget. You want to be able to manage the marketing, PR, all the way up until the show's opening, running all the operations of it, handling all the marketing during the show and seeing how things are going with the audience and the show and the finances. And it's pretty much, all that involved. And, run out and grab somebody lunch if they need it, because they're too busy working on the play. And I'll just do anything for the play.
So the producer is not necessarily the money person.
Well, the producer gets involved with the money. Me and John definitely, have an investment. We don't just invest our time in the play, but from the beginning to acquire rights, and to do the workshop and the development, we have to put up our own money. And then you go out there. I mean, it's a large investment to do an off-Broadway play. Off-Broadway is anywhere from, 300,000 to, you know, 1.5, it could be up to 2 million. Broadway starts to go a lot higher, and that's for a straight play, not a musical. So, you know, you do need a lot of people to be involved to raise these funds and to have investors come in or co-producers or associate producers. But as initial producers, we put the whole package together because, you know, this is something that we had a vision for. So we put the vision together for everybody. We get it started. We have an initial investment to get it started, which is a big risk. And then from that, you know, people can either join us if they believe in it or not, or even just see it as financially makes sense. So a lot more investors have to get involved.
Now, I'm curious as to when they say off-Broadway, what is the connotation of that? Because let's take, Avenue Q was on Broadway, and now it's off-Broadway. So what is – and that probably may confuse people. So
yeah.
What the
well, – and actually Avenue Q, I believe, did start off-Broadway and moved up to Broadway. And now they're back off Broadway, and pretty much basically what that means is really just it's the size of the audience. So the seating in the theaters. So off Broadway is from above 99 seating, all the way up to I believe 499, and then over that you start going into Broadway style theaters. So it's the amount of seats that are available to the audience. And, of course, you know, it's meant to be for, you know, mostly the New York area.
Now, so what is – and then off Broadway? Is that below 99?
Correct.
Okay. So it doesn't – so it, and when they say that, do they all mean that it's expected to be in Manhattan?
Yeah, I mean, that's
at
usually
least.
that's a term that's definitely used in Manhattan. You know, outside of Manhattan, they'll use regional theater or community theater, and there's a number of other terms. There have been a couple of theaters outside of Manhattan that get kind of a Broadway status, though. You know, they're larger theaters. They have good reputations.
Okay. So now let's go into this whole idea of you have the critics coming to the shows. I already got Don't Depend on Me. I mean, I look at some shows and when I see the critics, I go, did these people see the same show that I did? But
yeah. Well, we know that feeling, Merle.
I mean, it gets weird. I mean, there really have been shows that I'm going, really, what's the matter with these? They like that one?
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, so now what happens is that you've gotten what's considered mixed reviews. What do you do now? Let's begin with, who's the decision maker in whether it stays or goes. Now, I know you already have what's called a limited run, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. Before I get to what you're going to do or whatever, when you have a limited run, does that mean is there an open door for that? Like if you see that the show, if a show is going well, can you continue, or is the theater already booked for the next show? How does that work?
Yeah, well, we always had a plan that Let's Kill Grandma This Christmas could be bigger than this. But again, like this is John and myself's first big production. So what we needed to do is first and foremost is get it out there. Get it out there for the audiences. Get it out there for the world to see and experience this play and let it live where we know it could live. And on that aspect, you know, it's a very much big success because every night the audiences love it. And every night Brian, myself, and John are there to greet the audience and to converse with them afterwards and just really take in this experience. And they all love to leave their comments and their quotes and all that. So, but, you know, when, again, going back to the raising of the funds, you know, it takes a lot of money to raise enough funds to go into a theater and rent it out and say, you know, we want to be open-ended run. Like, we want to run as long as we can, as long as people keep coming. It's a lot of money up front. And so we said, was, let's go in with a plan of let's get the most weeks possible, which was 6 weeks. We picked a great time of year. And we said, let's go in, and we're going to show it to the world, and let's look at our options afterwards. You know, we're giving the play to everybody out there, and, you know, not just our investors, but there are other people that come see the show and show interest of either taking it to the next level, taking it on tour, trying to get the play out there, trying to get licensing for it. So we are very, very open to, you know, bringing it to the next level or reopening it at another time. But we had to go in with the limited run just because of the financing of it. So that's why, you know, and then, and in that particular theater is not an open-ended run theater. So there are limited engagements. You know, the St. Clement's Theater has other shows coming in at other times. So if we do continue it, or if we move it to a bigger venue, then we would have to find a new venue.
Oh, okay. So in other words, it will go to, is it January 5th or something like that?
January 6th.
January 6th. Okay.
Yeah.
And so in other words, what will happen, well, for instance, so that's now you take a, and I'm just like throwing out like the show Scandalous, which I thought, I don't know whether, I thought it got decent reviews. That's what I thought. And yet that closed. And do they have to close, especially a Broadway show? When you're dealing with a Broadway show, do you have to close because you can't afford the next week? Is that what winds up happening?
You know, that's pretty much it. It's like, and I'm not too familiar with Scandalous, but I know, like, recently The Anarchist with a major playwright, David Mamet, and some major stars, Patti LuPone and Deborah Winger, had to close because they got bad reviews. And so what happens is if the sales, ticket sales are not coming in, and then on top of it, you're not getting the good, great reviews. And again, you can get great reviews and some ticket sales cannot come in. There are a lot of different metrics that are involved in there. But if they're open and then they announce a close, it's because they cannot sustain the operating expenses. They're not, either they don't have enough cash in the bank to, you know, a lot of times, you know, some shows get enough money in the bank and they know that it's going to be word of mouth and it's going to take a while for the momentum to build up. And so they could last 6 to 9 months and say, you know what, this is going to take a while to build up. And by that time, we have enough money in the bank to sustain us. And then there are other shows that want to get off the ground and say, let's put it up and let's get it out there. If it works, it works. You know, we'll keep it going. If not, you know, we can't sustain it. You know, we're going to have to close down. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, it's like you said. It's like when you said you saw the review and you're like, did they see what I saw? You know, it's one of my first experiences with this, especially as a producer, to get reviewed like that and to see some awesomely great reviews. And actually, even on the same night, you know, we saw three great reviews on one night, and on that same night, only one other person gave us a negative review. And so you look, and just like you said, like, did they see what we see? And so it kind of, as a producer, you know, as the cast members and Brian, they really have to ignore the critics. They really do. And even as John, as the director, it's one person's opinion. It really is. The unfortunate part is that they are representing a newspaper that has a readership, that has a following, and if they're writing for them, they're putting their trust in that writer. So, you know, they all have to really ignore that. I want to concentrate on it because I always have to try and do my best to make it better, to see what they really saw, to see how it's affecting the ticket sales, to see how it's affecting the audiences, And so I really got inquisitive, and I was just like, who is this person? You know, and I'll just say it to New York Times, like, why was it so negative? And the great reviews were very specific of why they got the play, you know, why they really enjoyed it, you know, the theme, the relationships, the comedic parts, how it's, you know, very provocative, and the dialogue is very sharp, and that's what's great, and they're very specific. And then I look something at the Times, and I'm like, why did this person write it, and what's their history? And I'm seeing that this person is an economy writer, and she's focusing on three words of the play, which was Just Ask O.J. And I'm like, you know, there are thousands of other words in this play. We've been commented for the sharp dialogue. That night, many audience members enjoyed it, where we got partial standing ovation. And so you're just getting put, you're like, why? Like, why did this person, like, I understand they have an opinion, but there's a difference between them not liking it or it's not their taste to really going to like. And I'll say it, you know, they called Brian, they mentioned that his writing was lazy. And you know, as I asked my cast members and Brian as a writer not to get emotional, I got very emotional over that because Brian worked his butt off for more than 2 years. Brian was in the room every day of not just these rehearsals, but all the development workshops, working with the actors, trying different lines, going home at night by himself, turning over pages to us within a day. And I'm sorry, that's not lazy writing. You know, this guy's got a brilliant mind. He's got brilliant dialogue. He's an open-minded person. And that just really offends me. And so I had to do research on this person. I said, you know, why did they write that? And I find out they have an economics background and not too much in theater. And I'm like, well, that's kind of unfair that the New York Times sent that person. And again, it's only one person's opinion. Another critic could have, but we have to do damage control because a lot of people do read the New York Times.
Right.
And it probably did hurt some ticket sales because we listen to the New York Times. And what if they go, oh, wow, which we get all the time, great title. And, you know, what if they go and check the review? And we've had people the other day, somebody in from San Diego. We didn't know the guy. He's coming down. He's walking out. We're like, thank you so much for coming. If you would like to leave some comments. He's like, fabulous show. Excellent. The New York Times doesn't even know what they're talking about. And we're like, whoa, come back here. Come back here. You read the article and you still came here? And so that was a great experience because we know some people don't come. And we know that obviously people disagree with the New York Times. But, you know, to get back to that, I'm sorry for going off on the rant.
No, it's okay.
You know,
it's all right.
Yeah, it is very unfortunate that kind of stuff happens because we're a small show, and we worked our butts off for 2 years. And I even look at the hypocrisy of it. This is an economic writer, and I don't even think she understands economics because, you know, there was very hard work going into that set, the detail of that set. And we had a lot of, you know, not just the set designer and artist working on it, but we had hardworking builders, we had carpenters, we had painters that came in and worked on that set. And they did a wonderful job. And she doesn't even mention that. And the set is actually a character in the play. So I don't think she got the play, which we all know that in a way. But, you know, those people have to work again one day, and we all do. And, you know, I don't think she understands, like, we bring, you know, 100 to 150 people a night to that area who are spending money in the area, in the bars and restaurants. We employed over 30-something people. We put up a small business in this economy. And everybody worked their butts off, and I guess that's why even the mention of anything lazy was really, to me, offensive. And I say, you know, this is just this one person's opinion, but it's an attack in a way. So I don't even see it as a real review of the play because it was just somebody came in and attacked. So we have to do damage control, which is, you know, pick up on the marketing, concentrate on the great reviews we got. And we did. We got, like I said, the reviews that we got that were great, but so specific, and, you know, they got the relationships, and they got the characters, and they got the little, you know, they got Brian's voice, the things he had to say about politics. You know, it's not in your face. It's just these very subtle things that, especially for the two main characters at the end, that, you know, they're able to live a nice, simple life and not worry about crazy things. You know, the guy, the character of Ray, who just got back from the war, is just, you know, concentrating on love and concentrating on taking the positives in life. And I think it's just it was a great choice that Brian made of representing a war veteran. Yes, there are some crazy characters in there, and because it has to be entertaining. And he tells a wonderful story by creating this plot and putting all these different characters in there, and like some of the, you know, just sometimes, you know, some of these crazy, really, really bad thoughts that sometimes go into people's minds, whether it's about, you know, is it affordable to keep an old person alive? Are they going to eat away our inheritance? People think that, but they don't say it. Although this character is going to a level of wanting to take her out. But people think that this is what's going on in this economy today. This is what's going on in this world. He talks about people working their butts off and getting laid off. Talks about another character who's working 72 hours a week and can't get out of debt. And the way he blended it all together was wonderful, and the great reviews really got it. And we've been just concentrating on that, getting the word out, and also our audience comments, which is the best, because every night they enjoy it, and they love to write to us. And we get emails, we get comments, we get posts on the website. They've been going on other internet sites. I look at them and they post wonderful reviews, and we just try and really concentrate on those.
Well, that's good. Now the thing is, I brought one of my friends, and my friend Mark, who not only will critique a show, I mean, I said, come on with me to watch, come to see this show. He works with another newspaper, but Mark, His background, he has directed plays. He's an English teacher, former English teacher. So he has also directed community theater and been in some community theater as well. And I have, my whole background is show business. So I've done theater since I was like 14, where I was involved like with a repertory group. So,
right.
You know, so I know all the work that goes into theater, and Mark knows all the work that goes into theater. So to critique it is probably, I don't say it's easier, it's just I see it from a point of view of been there, done that, and I can, you know, and now I have to look at also what the audience, you know, what do I like, you know, and what do I like from a point of view of just being a, you know, theater goer.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I could analyze it because I've, you know, been in the theater. So
sure.
The thing is that when you're dealing in terms of critics, unfortunately, they look these things up and, who knows? They might have, now this woman, I don't know, the, you know, in terms of the New York Times, it could have been so-and-so can't go. Listen, you want to go? Yeah, but I don't do it. Oh, it's okay. Just go. Go review the show, you know, whatever. We, you know, I mean, they could be sending somebody who's really not a reviewer or somebody who, you know, like on the, you know, list of, I don't know, some people get on the A-list and don't deserve it.
From what we read, Merle, in the bio in the New York Times reviewer, it says she considers herself a lifelong theater nerd. And to answer the question of criticism versus taste, my opinion on that is a good critic, and there is good criticism, let's not forget that. Good criticism really understands theater. And it's not a theater nerd or not even a theater enthusiast. A good critic is someone who actually really understands the structure of plays, what it means to tell a story, plot line, and has a strong, strong history of understanding the language from Greek theater through Shakespeare up to contemporary work, and all experimental theater as well, so that when a criticism is given, it's given with a level of insight, and usually it's a dialogue between the critic and the playwright, and the audience being the reader,
happens to be the third party who comes in on that dialogue. So a good critic, you take someone like historically Frank Rich from the New York Times years ago, a good critic is dialoguing with you as the author, informing you what he or she saw, what she, he or she believes is working well, and often gives pats on the back about the incredibleness of that, and can also point out some things that may have been missed in terms of structure or insights into the play and so on and so forth. But we've, unfortunately, where things have shifted, and I think that Robert has hit on this, I know Brian may feel this way, and seems that what you're saying as well, Merle, is that it's criticism now has become personal taste. And that's a misuse of the word critic. Personal taste, you might as well just have a blog and say whatever you want about anything in the world. And then everyone has the right to speak. But we expect, as people who worked very hard to put up the play, we actually expected true criticism to come on the play. And interestingly enough, as Robert pointed out so well, is that the only people who seemed to review the play as a critic were the people who were actually talking about the play in a positive light. They actually talked about the play and what the play was doing and what Brian was doing as a playwright and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, where negative reviews showed up, it became all about what they would have wanted, or a personal taste came into the event, as opposed to historic criticism that you might have gotten from, you know, George Bernard Shaw, who was a critic as well as a playwright. And people who do criticism can often really help a playwright with his or her next play. They can really give a playwright some insight as to why something wasn't working. It really can be a very helpful dialogue, almost like an editor to a novelist. So, so it's unfortunate that we've gone to this thing where it's just you're sending over an economist who is a theater nerd to review a play that, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars are involved in. That part of it was disappointing. And it was clear to us that she did get to see an excellent performance, and she did get to see a partial standing ovation, and missed, ironically, that the hub of what Brian was talking about is who we are as people when we come upon hard economic times, which I found ironic considering she's an economist first for the New York Times. And the biggest thrust of what Brian's talking about in this play is what happens to people's moral compass when they're suddenly struck with an economic crisis of epic proportions, and who will we become? And Brian took a look at the savages and the cutthroatness of a nation, America, and what happens in America when Americans become desperate for financial success and are facing personal ruin, and the steps that they're, how far they're willing to go. Now, what he does is he uses this American family as a nucleus of that to show off this incredible point. And for her to have missed that as an economist and as a reviewer, I find embarrassing for her. And it unfortunately that ended up hurting us on some level, because the New York Times does have strong readership, and it does have a lot of respect. But also there's people like us who have to speak up and say, hey, the New York Times isn't always right. And to answer that, years ago Frank Rich wrote a book titled something, I might be paraphrasing it, titled, "Hey, They Weren't All That Bad." What he did was he went back and he looked over his own reviews. And where he felt he made a mistake as a reviewer, as a critic, he went back and corrected himself in this book to say, I might have made a mistake in a few places. And he listed something over 50 shows in that particular book. So we feel possibly that this is one of the shows that unfortunately some people are just missing the whole point and missing the whole style in which Brian writes. Brian was also accused of writing in an over-top way and over the top. Well, Brian has a very particular sweet note in his play. It's a very fine line. He doesn't take you to farce, and he doesn't take you to total reality. It's a fine line where it's almost appearing as if it's going over the top. The characters have a naturalistic to expressionistic and surreal quality to them. And some people don't understand that that's what he's playing with. He's playing with this not very real idea. It's a bumped out idea. It's bumped out characters, and it doesn't go as far as Sparse, but it is very bumped out. And some people can't seem to just basically see that that's intentional on his part. It's not a mistake. It's very intentional. He wants you to enjoy the festivity of theater, so he pumps them out just a tiny bit, and it's very, very important to catch that, or else you start criticizing the actors and the writer and thinking that, you know, quote, unquote, they're being lazy about what they're doing, when it's really deliberate and a lot of fun when you finally get it.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that has come up with shows, and here's a perfect example. I went to see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Now, I've never seen it, you know, I've never seen the play performed. I did see the movie many years ago and don't even remember the whole thing. But what was found very interesting, first of all, you have a play, a classic play with no stars. that was, you know, you have, and seeing the show, the subject itself, it's very upsetting. It could be very upsetting to see the show, but as a critic, in terms of the performance and everything else, I would say, you know, if you could deal with 3 hours, you know, and the subject, by all means, go see the show, because the acting was superb. And you know, it's the drama, it's the play itself was excellent. It didn't matter, I mean, that there were no stars in it, and obviously it doesn't always make a difference. But it's not, in terms of my opinion of it, it's not my opinion of whether I liked it or not. I mean, from a standpoint of somebody who's been in the theater, it was excellent, but I didn't necessarily like it because, you know, the whole subject. But
right.
In terms of my criticizing it, I'm saying it's, you know, oh, by all, you know, two thumbs up. I mean, like, go see it, because it's somebody, I don't know if your average audience will appreciate it, but somebody who's into the theater will say, wow. I mean, it'll get standing ovation, because, as a matter of fact, in the audience, George Takei, I can't remember how to pronounce his name, from Star Trek. He was in the audience, and I looked at him afterwards, and I went, how did they do a second show in day? I mean, it was like you could see the female star, how drained she was at the end of the show. But this is, as I said, in terms of critiquing it, I always look at something: will you be entertained? You're paying money and you want to see something. Are you going to say this was, you know, entertaining, and not meaning? I mean, you can't. I mean, your show is a comedy. I mean, entertaining doesn't necessarily mean you had to laugh, kind of thing. You know, because, you know, there could shows that are dramas, but that's really what it boils down to, is whether you're going out for the evening or afternoon, and will you be entertained? And that's how I look at a show.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're saying something really important, which is, can you remain objective even though the subject matter doesn't necessarily appeal to you? And I think that's the whole point of quality criticism. I think it's very important to say something is phenomenal and everyone should go see it, even though it doesn't necessarily speak to me and my likes. What you're saying is you're able to recognize excellence, even though personally, it may not be subject matter that you are interested in. And I think that's a very, very important quality in criticism, which is you have to be able to take yourself out of the equation and simply look at the work as possibly can. The job of a critic is to be as objective as possible so that the work itself can truly be criticized. And I agree, I couldn't agree with you more. If people are laughing at a comedy, the comedy is a success. Because to get laughs from people, nothing is more true or more difficult to do than to have strangers walk into a room and make them laugh. Nothing is more difficult than that. Ask any stand-up comedian that story. It is difficult to get people to laugh. It takes a particular ear, a style, and a team of people. A comedy is the truest audience you will ever find, because when you're not getting laughs, you're really not getting laughs. And when you are getting laughs, you're getting laughs. And it's as simple as that. And in Brian's case, he's able to get total strangers laughing consistently. And that's the bottom line. And for anyone to refer to him as lazy, or that's lazy or easy, or even implying by laziness that it's easy to do that, shame on them.
I kind of saw that, and I didn't understand that. When I went, lazy? What was lazy? I thought they made a mistake or something. I didn't understand.
I would just like to say something. She did point out, again, three words of the OJ joke. She points out at the end that it got laughs, and which was shocking that she did that. And she gave the credit to the actress, which absolutely the actress delivered it well. But you can't deliver something well without it being in the writing as well. That's one thing, again, she didn't get. And what I find about it is that she said that it was lazy. She mentions OJ twice in the article. And doing some research on her, because, of course, I need to be a critic of her now, I find she writes a whole article on the Kardashian wedding and the economics of it. And I'm sorry, but, you know, Kardashian wouldn't be popular today if it wasn't for OJ. So OJ is still somewhat relevant in people's minds. And it worked. It works every night. We get the biggest laugh on that line. Why? Because everything that came before that, it landed on it. And Brian has tried different lines, and it's not lazy. Brian worked hard. And guess what? That gets the response. It gets the immediate understanding of what that character wanted to say. And it, boom. And the fact that she points that out is absolutely amazing, especially since the hypocrisy of her writing an article, which all she did was gather numbers from other sources and then put a little spin on it. But she's writing about somebody who's actually still related to the same subject matter that, you know, unfortunately, for anybody who lived in the last 20, 30 years, they do understand that. They do understand the relevance of, you know, how this has affected America. So, and Brian's just putting that one little piece in it. It's three words into this very large play. And the only reason why it works is because of everything that he led up from beginning up until that point, which is near the end of the play, and not too far into the end, but, you know, it worked, and it's amazing. And she heard the laughs, and she mentioned it. And it's just, so why is she saying it's lazy is beyond, I can't even fathom until I have a conversation with
her. Let's look at another step. Let's talk about now with the marketing. I see things like, I get emails like there's an event place or something, and they send... then they do trades. What kind of determine what you want to do in terms of marketing, in terms of either discounts or freebies kind of thing to pack an audience?
Yeah, well, again, we have some really good, actors that have some great credits. They have Broadway credits, big Broadway credits. They have some big film and TV credits. But in the end, you see what's out there in today's world, in the theater right now. I mean, Paul Rudd and Michael Shannon are on stage together, and even that show has discounts. And even that show has to do big marketing. And there's a number of stars on Broadway today and off Broadway Jake Gyllenhaal is also, and they have to constantly, and they just, you know, they had to discount their tickets as well. So what you do is you have a game plan, you know, because if it's not somebody really, really big, you know, I mean, currently right now Al Pacino's on stage, and a lot of people want to see Al Pacino live, and that's great. So, you know, you make a plan. You say, okay, Brian's a first-time produced at this level writer. We're first-time big producers. We're trying to get this name out there. How do we build the momentum, and how do we get this going? And so, you know, you want to target people in the very beginning of getting discounts to get in the door and see the previews, because we know that this is the type of play that's word of mouth. We can't take a big billboard like Elf does on Times Square and pay $100,000.
Right.
So we take one of the smallest billboards that we know a lot of people are going to be passing by, you know, on the block of 44th Street. And because we know there's people going to John's Pizzeria and Saudi's Restaurant, and they'll be going to Rock of Ages. And when we can't spend as much, but they can still see our billboard, and we still have a presence in all of this big world of Broadway and off-Broadway in New York City. But so we start off with some discounts, and because everybody, it's unfortunately the financing of it and the marketing of it is everybody is looking for a discount. And again, this is a play that would be word of mouth, so we get people in the door, and we target theatergoers. We buy email lists or email blasts that go targeting off-Broadway theatergoers, because a lot of people who go to off-Broadway, they love off-Broadway. You know, they're not the tourists coming in, they have to see a Wicked or they have to see a big musical. They are looking for that. And then we do trades with small publications that are going to the outside communities in Queens, in Rockland, in Brooklyn, in Staten Island, in the New Jersey areas. And we do some kind of trades with them because, you know, we get their people in to see the show, and they'll run, you know, a small ad for us because we want to connect with them. Some of them we pay for, and some of them we'll trade with them. We'll trade tickets because the tickets have value. You know, they'll give to their clients because it's a show that, you know, they don't just take any show. They take a show that seems appealing, that they would want to go to themselves, and that is value to them from their clients. So we try stuff like that because, you know, we have a marketing budget, but again, it's not as big as the big shows. The main thing is getting the money into the product on stage, getting the right casting, getting the right set design, getting the right theater, and then you go about all these different marketing, and you know, you have press opportunities, and you have email blasts, and you place ads on different websites that our theatergoers go to. And, you know, then you go out with other offers because you want to reach, you know, we have a play that we believe even reaches the person who normally doesn't go out because it is a fun night out. So we really want to get out there into the world. So, you know, we've looked upon all our different options of not just going to theatergoers, but going out to people who are just looking for live events. You know, we do group events. We invite a whole group night out. We go out to people who are just looking for what's good to do with the holidays. They have family and friends in. So we try to attack a broad spectrum and get a lot of different people into the audience because the main thing is just for people to come in and have a great time and hear Brian Jouncey's words. That's the most important.
So what happens is you have a company that does the PR, then you have a separate company that you're dealing with marketing.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, they present us with different opportunities to advertise, to market here, and then we kind of make the decisions.
Well, for instance, what would make you decide who to do a trade with, like with a newspaper?
Is it up to
the marketing person to make the decision, or do they turn to you and say, this newspaper wants to do it, do you want to do it?
Well, yeah, well, they give us their experience, too, right? So they go, you know, this is a newspaper we have, you know, very good experience with. You have that type of play that you know, we want to reach the blue-collar workers out there in Queens and Brooklyn and all over there. We want to give them the opportunity. They are people that don't come in often for plays, and if we give them a discount, then maybe they'll take a ride in and come see your play because you have a great catchy title. You have some people that they might have seen on their watching at home in their homes of Boardwalk Empire. And so let's go after those people, and with our experience, we see a return. We see people take advantage of this. So, you know, that's the kind of dialogue that we have in those marketing meetings.
Okay. Because I was just thinking of if you wanted to, you know, with the Queens Times, because we do trades at times.
Okay.
And I do it to help boost the show as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, who would I actually get in touch with? Joe?
Joe could set that up because Joe comes to all our marketing meetings. Yeah, you could
okay.
Absolutely set that up with Joe.
Okay. Now I was just kind of curious about that. So there are different. You find many means to get it out. I guess it's interesting in terms of the critics of as I looked on the who was doing it or what publications, it was like there's another problem in terms of, and people need to really look at it, when you do have critics, you know, critics come in there with an ego. I can make or break a show. Look, I have power.
And they come in with, and they also come in with this idea of they're trying to make a name for themselves. They're young. They don't have a lot of experience. They're looking to establish a voice in their communities. There's a lot of competition among each other and how they perceive one another. There's a lot of factors that go in that I think people don't necessarily understand the wholeness of it, and that, you know, criticism, while at its ideal, would be to be as objective as possible and as educated as possible on the subject matter of literature in particular. It's unfortunate that we've slipped away from that in terms of even a big newspaper like the New York Times. That it's kind of a sad situation when a giant like the New York Times will actually send an economist over to review a play. I find that quite embarrassing for them. It's a sad state of affairs.
Well, let me ask a question in terms of when you're inviting the critics, who makes the choice? Is it, do you go by the A-list, so to speak, or how does that work?
No, we welcome everybody. You know, we welcome everybody. You know, we're not, you know, it's, this play is something we stand by. I mean, there's no way that John and I could have invested 2 years of our lives if we did not believe
play. What I'm asking,
yeah,
because in terms of especially like Broadway, in other words,
right,
I already know, like I find out who the PR company is. If there's a particular PR company that's doing it, I know already I'm not going to be able to go. I ain't going to get tickets to see it because I'm not on the A-list.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And which is a game, because I got to realize I'm not on the A-list because I'm probably forgot to suck up to a whole bunch of people. That's what.
Good for you,
and,
bro.
And it took time for me to realize, because I'm thinking to myself, how can I not be on the A-list? If I mean, I've been reviewing Broadway shows for at least 15 years. What does it take for me to be on the A-list? And as I, you know, and I started to ask, like, who makes these decisions?
Well, you
and
know,
then I got to a point where the PR companies themselves, and I'm saying, I get it. So if I've been doing it, if I haven't sucked up to them, let's say I haven't, and I don't make it a point of, you know, of calling up and say, hey, how you doing? Have a Merry Christmas. I mean, I don't do that. And I get, you know, and
go ahead.
Yeah, and probably because I haven't done that, I didn't get to make the A-list. So it's just that I just know in that particular PR company, you know, if there's a show that they're doing, then I'm out of luck. I don't get to, you know, to see that one. In your case, you're not dealing with. An A-list. You don't have to look at that. You depend on Joe to make the decision.
Well, yeah, we depend on Joe. Joe has his relationships. You know, we, again, we're first time. Brian didn't have a big play produced. You know, David Mamet, if he did it himself for $100,000, you know, and said, I'm just producing myself in a small theater, he's probably going to get, you know, still the New York Times to go review it, you know. And they're going to pick it up. They're going to want to go. But when we're dealing with Joe, you know, we want it. You know, again, me and John invested 2 years, and we want it. We want to invite everyone, you know, and we wanted everyone to see. We were not afraid of the A-listers, you know, giving us a bad review because we stood by this product. And we wanted to invite as many people as possible because I'll give you this promise. I make it to Broadway, Merle. Not only would I absolutely invite you, but I would have an open invite to anyone because to me is, even at Broadway, they will, a lot of these producers or a lot of these finance people will cry that they don't have new people coming to Broadway. Well, maybe that's why, you know? I'm sure your listeners, you know, that if you did review a Broadway show, you know, you got to see that particular show and you could resonate and you give a good critique and you talk about it on your show, you're going to connect with a few people that they might not have connected with. And they always want to, you know, go with the big time. We got the big billboard for when the tourists arrive in Times Square, and right, we're going to do the New York Times, and we're going to do all the main things. And sometimes I hear that a lot in marketing meetings. Well, this is what they usually do, and this is what they usually do. And me and John will always say, well, we don't want to do what people usually do. We worked our butts off. We want to do anything and everything the smart way and in a very positive way, but we're very open. I mean, even Brian himself, he's out on TKTS talking to the tourists, talking to anybody who's in the area who might be looking for a show. And he talks to them about his show. He says, I'm the playwright, which there's no other playwrights that I know that are out there. And even if they're hesitant, you know, they're hesitant of maybe the foul language or they're hesitant of the subject matter, he says, well, if you give me a try, he says, I think you're going to thank me at the end of the night for a very good night out, and I'll be there for you to either thank me, and if you were disappointed, I'm going to take you out for a drink. And I tell you, I'm there every night. I witness it, and they thank him. They thank him. Even one lady says that language was rough, but you're a genius writer. She's like, I still left. And it's just so wonderful to see that these people took a chance. And Brian is out. I'm not kidding. He's out there 8 hours a day. That's why he lost his voice. That's why he's very quiet right now. We told him that he's taking a break. And so we're just very open, you know. And I promise you this, and I know John, you know, a long time now. You know, we do not want to ever close our eyes to any kind of list. We don't put anybody in any kind of category. You know, we have something to share with the world. We want to share with the world. And if somebody's out there with good intentions and they want to come see the play and they want to review it for their listeners and they just want to pass the information on, and again, it could be, this wasn't for me, but I heard people laughing in the audience. You know, there was some pretty good shop dialogue. The subject matter, I could never deal with, you know, possibly somebody offering, you know, killing an older person for money. And, you know, that's fine. That's all fine. We understand everybody's got a difference of opinion. But we are never afraid of to have anybody in, and we're more than welcome because we want to reach somebody. You know, somebody, you know, we had somebody in from San Diego the other day. If we get somebody in South Jersey that normally doesn't come to Broadway, we got them in the door because Adam Mucci's on Boardwalk Empire, or because there's some interview in a New Jersey newspaper, or because somebody heard your radio show. Wow, we welcome that, you know, and we'd love to be their first off-Broadway experience.
Well, then you also have another thing out there, which is also interesting, is that I will, like the PR company, a PR company will say, well, we only have a limited amount of tickets. The producer only gives us a limited amount of tickets in terms of the critics. And what I think is kind of interesting about this thing is it's not as if, like, They're talking about every time they give out tickets, they give out pairs of tickets. Now, I don't know about you, but, I mean, it's like I really do enjoy that I could bring people to the theater with me, but this is my job. That person who's with me goes home, and you know, they had a good time. They don't have any work to do.
Yeah.
I go home. I got to work because I got to write.
Yep.
But, you know, but they say it's, I don't understand. It's like, but if you have as let's say you have 100 tickets to give out, that means only really 50 pairs of tickets to give out. If you gave it out and say, well, we're only giving it out to the critic themselves because they're going to go out to work. They have to bring somebody to work all the time. Then you got 100 critics.
Well, I'll tell you what's going on there, Merle. I think people are BSing a tiny bit, and anybody that says no to you or any other person who is a critic is finding a way to using false politeness and pushing that off on producers. I don't think that there's a credible producer in this country that wouldn't want critics in the room to help promote their play. So and wherever you're hearing that, that's unfortunate.
Well, it's not the producer type of thing. It's the fact that for some reason there's an assumption that when you go to the theater, when you go to the movies, when you go out to eat, you can't do it alone. They don't want people to go alone. And I'm going, I don't understand. I could go alone.
I think it's a politeness, perhaps, people are saying, well, let's give them 2 tickets so that they can have someone with them.
They can bring somebody. And it's like,
yeah, it's a politeness.
But why? I mean, if you think about it, other businesses, I mean, like, oh, I'm going to go, you know, I have some plumbing work to do. Wait a second. Let's see who I can invite to come and sit.
You
watch
got a great
the,
point going.
You know,
you got a
watch,
great point.
You know, oh, I'm going to work
that,
today. I have a lot of invoices to do. Who can I invite to watch me type?
Exactly. And don't you find that whoever you're with has a deep, I have found this to be a very, very true experience for me, whether I see a movie or see a play. Whoever I see a movie or who I see a play with has a profound influence on my experience as well. And if I've seen movies alone or seen theater alone, which I have done plenty of times,
yeah,
it's amazing how pure that experience can be. It can be very, the solitude of being there by oneself has a powerful, powerful influence of how that play directly affecting you. Whereas if I'm sitting next to a friend, I will never forget years ago when I saw The Pillow Man on Broadway. I was sitting with a friend, and she was hysterically laughing to the point where she was laughing so much, I had to look over at her several times because I couldn't believe the level of hysteria. I was laughing too, but not in this way where I thought she was going to literally hemorrhage because it was so much. And it was distracting in a way because I wasn't able to totally get involved in the play. And that's not the first time that that had happened to me, where I had been with people where some people just were sitting next to me and clearly didn't like the play that I was enjoying. And that was starting to make me feel uncomfortable. So it does have an influence on you as a critic. I would think that who you bring to the show with you has an enormous effect on whether you are having a good time or not.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I notice, like, there are some people I bring, and I keep seeing the habit of they need to voice something.
Right, right.
I'm concentrating on the show. I really don't.
Right,
you know,
I know exactly. I know where you're going. Absolutely.
You know, like, okay, say it in your head.
But they want to put their little influence on you, right, Merle?
Well, it's not as much the influence. It's just the comment as if, and I'm going, what was that about? Or, you know, it was,
right,
I don't
right.
know. I don't want to say it on the air because then whoever it is will know what I'm talking about if I say things. But so that deters it only because, yeah, there's the whole politeness of, you know. But then again, there's this whole thing with showbiz. I once wrote up a routine about showcasing, or what would happen if other people showcased, like people that are not that are not comedians or singers. What if you made them showcase as well, you know, and you had you held a showcase and you had people come in and watch them, you know, type or watch them, you know, do something. Oh, we have so-and-so here who's now going to do, who's going to perform an appendectomy. Let's see. Okay. A round of applause. And by the way, it's a 2-drink minimum. And a cover. I mean, if you really think about how funny it could be to have people that are not in show business showcase. I mean, who would do it for free? What other people would do their job for free so they could say, oh, listen, I'm not sure who I want to hire to fix my roof. Why don't you have you come over and you do about an hour's work and then I'll take a look at it and I'll invite some friends over and they can see it too. And by the way, I can't afford to just have them come over, so I'll have them pay $5 a piece to watch you do the roof. If I like what you did, maybe I'll hire you, or maybe I'll have you back again to
exactly.
do some more work. I mean, really, it's the only business that they take advantage of the people.
Yeah, it's definitely a kooky business in that way. That's for sure.
Yeah, but anyway, well, I think we've done well on this subject already of all this. Well, I can't say I hope you go past January 6th because that's a decision. But I hope that that you get at least the word of mouth out there. And as you said, you never know. You then have to decide what you're going to do with the show, where you're going to bring it, how you're going to work, and will you put it on tour? And also, in terms of like touring the subject, in terms of being a Christmas type thing, will it work when it's not around the season of Christmas? Is something that you would probably have to look at as well, I guess, right?
Well, I definitely think the play itself works without question as a play.
Yeah.
The title in no way should invite people to think that it's only a holiday piece. I think that the play has an opportunity to become one of the holiday classics that people take a look at during the holiday season or every few holiday seasons, so on and so forth. It certainly, I think, has a regional appeal because of its particular look at America and how desperate Americans get around financial crises and a lot of other dysfunctional family elements that Brian speaks to. But in no way, I think, is the play is limiting to a holiday season. I think that Brian's much more expansive than that as a playwright. The ideas inside this play are much richer than simply a holiday festivity. However, I do think the specificity of the holidays gives it a unique look at the family, because we all know that that's a time of year when we come together as family and we get an opportunity to see who we are. And what we're like, we're all very different as individuals in the world, and I don't know what happens, whether we all just regress when we get back home. I don't know what happens, but the man I am in the world is certainly not the man I am when I get home.
Yeah. Okay. All right, guys. So I guess break a leg for the next, how many, 3 weeks? How many weeks are left?
Yeah, three, a little bit more than 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Oh. It's amazing how the time goes by. I'm going, is it the end of the year already?
It's going fast. Thank you for your time today, Merle. We really appreciate that.
Yes,
You're
and thank
quite
you for
welcome.
Coming to the show, too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. But then I have a sick sense of humor anyway.
Yeah, we
love it.
About the play, Merle.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Thank
bye-bye.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye. Yes. Well, go see the show. I mean, it's funny. That's all. It's sick, but it's funny. That's what counts. It's entertaining. Now, before I, well, let's, okay. I got to get up some more music on here. I guess it's me that, so let's hit a sponsor.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra leg room.
Uh-huh. We have extra leg room as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No. No, that is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of leg room.
Ah.
I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling JetBlue.
Dear traveler, stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue. Based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
Yes, I'll be JetBlueing, I guess, after, way after Christmas. Like way after, when it gets a little, when it gets warmer again. Let's see, I want to put out there. Just, oh, by the way, Megabus. I don't know if anybody heard Megabus. Go to Megabus.com, Megabus.com. They're giving away free rides. You can go on the bus. You can go round trip to a whole bunch of places on the bus for nothing. It's not a sweepstakes. They're giving out, I think it's like they said, 200,000 free tickets because they want people to travel between now, I think it's between now and the end of February. You can't go every place. I looked at the thing and I think it's a 50-cent service charge. So for 50 cents, I can go round trip from New York to Providence, Rhode Island. That's what I chose as a city to go to only because I've never been there. And also I didn't want to do a 17-hour trip to do this. So that's one of the things. The other things, if you have a sports, for the holidays, if you have a sports fan they're looking to buy a gift for, okay. I'll say, take for instance, you know that, the Nets have the Brooklyn Nets. If you can go to NBA Store Manhattan, you can check out the store on the Brooklyn Nets website. Or you may even get a better bargain by going to a website called Fanatics, which is as in www.fanatics.com, FANATICS.com. And you don't have to worry whether they're the real thing. I checked it out. But what's great is they have gear for a slew of teams. Various sports, even the Olympics, and that's great for like either like nostalgia, because they have things like if you didn't want the Brooklyn Nets, but you wanted whatever they were called, New York Nets, right? And also, if somebody's like a foreign team, like in the Olympics, or somebody who was a college, and you know, a college that they went to, and you get them something, piece of clothing is collectible. So go to, that's one place, go to fanatics.com for a gift. I'm going to be checking out other types of gifts, not for, you can get either in time for the holidays, or there are a lot of people like, after the holidays, they get to see somebody they didn't get to see during the holidays, and you want to get a holiday gift for somebody afterwards. And I'm looking to, well, I don't know, so they endorse the products. I just find them interesting. So I also just wanted to say, to reiterate about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Steppenwolf Company is the one that originally did this in a Broadway show like years ago. And it's the Steppenwolf Company that's doing it again. It also has a limited run, I think, until something like the middle of February. And as I said, I didn't like the subject. The comedy was great. The timing of everything, the comedy was excellent. And the performance was totally something to be behold. I mean, it was just, you know, it definitely worth seeing. If you could sit for the 3 hours. Well, so there are two intermissions. The other thing that I recently saw was Mum and Chance. You know, it's like I try to describe Mum and Chance. It's like trying to verbally describe how to tie your shoelaces. Try that one day without being able to actually show somebody. See if you can actually even write it down of how to do it. It's even harder to write it down. But anyway, so Mum and Chance, and it's you're probably better off like going to mumandchance.com, MUMMENSCHANZ, I think. To get an idea of what this is, it's a nonverbal theatrics is what it is, and it's something that the entire family will love. Now, I know they're in New York right now, also with a limited run, but I believe that they'll be going on tour, and it's always a delight. That's got to be a delight for anybody to see, and it's kids absolutely adore it because it's just you're taking a fabric and you're making it funny, and you have to appreciate the actors who are doing this because sometimes you go, it's a lot of how do they do it, and then there were also times they were all dressed like in black, so at times you may see an object go across the stage and you don't see anybody, and because it's because of the lights, so A Mum and Chance is another one to see. Another, I don't know if I talked about Bear, B-A-R-E, the musical, my only disappointment at that one is that it's an off-Broadway show. I hope it goes to Broadway. To me, it was kind of a gay version of Spring Awakening. And the music is great, the acting is great, everything about it's funny, it's poignant, you know, the whole bit. So that's my take. As a matter of fact, I see it right now. To me, it was the best musical I've seen this season. I'm not saying that the shows aren't good. This is the best of this season that I've seen in terms of musicals. So anyway, until next time, not sure what I'm doing at all. Have a great day, evening, afternoon, or whatever you do. Oh, tomorrow, that's right, I'm going to see the Gay Men's Chorus at Town Hall with the guest star of Judy Collins. Yes, Judy Collins is going to be the guest star. Actually, I'm going with my friend Sarah Rice, who hopefully will be performing more than I than she is. Or I just got to get my ass out and see her perform. Anyway, back to it. So, goodbye, everybody. Let's go find this, my ending. Let's see. Music, here we go. The chickens are asleep. Cats are asleep. They're all...